Yesterday, in the session that you were able to attend, we were able to hear some rather important and new information about the listening process. And as you know, through your own work and through any other kind of work, getting people to listen can be a real challenge. Canon Phil Groves, the facilitator of the listening process, has been a stalwart supporter of that listening process, and through diligence and patience and energy, has been able to raise the level of listening in the communion. And that was certainly highlighted at Lambeth, among other places. Yesterday he made an announcement, an important one, about a way for the continuing Indaba process to bear some greater fruit. And so we've asked Phil to come to say perhaps a word about that, and we'll open it again, as we always do, to questions. Good sir, to you.
Thank you. Well, you heard what I said, and you had the paper that came out. We're looking to, at the request of many, and particularly resulting from the request from the Windsor Continuation Group, looking to extend mutual listening through a process of what we've entitled Continuing Indaba, with a recognition of the limitations of the Indaba process at the Lambeth Conference, seeking to expand. We've heard many of the criticisms, lack of time brought up by people. Chris highlighted that in his article. Issues to do with, is it just bishops? Do we need to extend that? How we listen to one another. So we've been working with the organisation you heard in the USA that has a consensus-based model, and in cultural application we've insisted, and they've been very happy with us ensuring that such a process must be within the Anglican way, must take the authority of the scriptures in how we do things, in how we talk to one another. So we will be extending our look at biblical models of listening. We have a few in the communion, but we need to expand those. We need to take seriously cultural models, particularly non-Western models. So looking genuinely at what it means for African Indaba process from an African perspective. What other models of consensus building, of going through listening into decision-making in other cultural understandings, and escaping from a purely kind of Western top-down democratic, adversarial democratic, we're in favour of democracy of course, but adversarial democratic processes, so that we can do the kind of mutual listening which faces people with hard questions and doesn't presume that we at the Communion Office have any of the answers, which we don't. Those need to be discovered within the communion rather than imposed from any way from a preformed package from above. Does that give you that gives you a way in, so we can probably...
we'll start this way this time. So Mary Frances, first one to you, and please remember to identify yourself and where you're from.
Mary Frances Schoenberg, Episcopal News Service. You said yesterday that you expect hard questions and some difficult times. Can you say something more about that? What do you think the most difficult part of this process can be?
Well, I think Archbishop Reed said that we... it's great that the communion's come here, because otherwise we get insular and isolated. And I think that you can come up to solutions that work for you in your little world. Now, they everything seems to kind of fit together, whatever that solution is. And that could be with gay and lesbian people. It could be we bless those relationships. It could be a very we've worked it all out. We know all the answers here in our world. But there might be other questions that come in from another place that will be extremely challenging. Some of the Episcopal Church bishops that I talked to at the Lambeth Conference were going, gosh, it's not quite as simple as I thought it was. It's not just about human rights. And maybe human rights aren't as all overwhelmingly the defining issue that I thought it was. I had an email a couple of years back from someone, North America, could be from Canada. It said, it's the baptismal covenant, duh, as if that's the answer to everything. And actually, if you talk to when the bishops talk to Africans and Asians and people from with other concepts, their world isn't quite as secure as they thought it was. But on the other hand, say, for example, the Bishop of Amritsar, when he came, he said, I'm not going to listen to any of this liberal stuff. I'm just going to talk about, I'm going to stick to the, you know, I know what it is. I know what is the answer. But when he heard others, he said, actually, it's a bit more complicated than I thought it was. And maybe it's not quite as simple a construct as we've decided where we are. And we need to know how to respond to lesbian and gay people who are real people with all their kind of desires for companionship and love, which we know come right essential to our human nature from Genesis 1. And what are we going to respond? And he doesn't say, oh yeah, now I've decided to bless same-sex. I mean, the Diocese of Amritsar is not blessing same-sex unions at this point from that experience. And nobody expects them to. But they're actually, I mean, what are we then going to do? How do we live? And actually that conversation had together might be incredibly creative and might actually enable us to walk through some of these impasses as we move away from isolation and being insular. And I think it has great hope for the communion, but it's not going to be easy because it's much easier to stick with your preformed view. I mean, I would say that's the Ephesian moment in Andrew Walls. That's what he talks about. It's much easier for the Gentiles to say the Jews are not Christians because they're not like us, and for the Jews to say they're not Christians because they're not like us. Paul says there is one body of the church. Christ is Lord. Huge diversity. How are we going to be one church? I don't think even he had the answer worked out in all details about how that was going to be, but he told the Ephesians, that's what you've got to work on and get on with. So I think that's what we're looking at.
Tess Heeson from the Anglican Journal. How much of the listening process is happening or has happened within the Anglican Communion? And have you kept track of the number of provinces that have been participating or have undertaken this process?
Well, it isn't a process that we set out in a preformed format. And Bishop Munir yesterday very clearly, and I think very, very deeply expressed, you know, the different cultural context means that it happens in a different way. And how impossible, he'd love to get on and do a listening, but that context makes it very difficult. In other places, Burundi's report on their summary of their report and their response said, actually, we're living in the context where our neighbours have had civil war. We could fall into civil war. We've got education issues. We've got AIDS, HIV. How can you expect us to engage in this? And I think that's an entirely valid position to be in. So have they engaged? Well, yeah, for example, Bishop P came to the General Synod of Canada and engaged with all kinds of people, both to hear what was being said, but also to reflect on that, so that they've got a reflection of what if we're asked what is the Burundian response within this, but actually. We also want to know that the Church of Canada is concerned for the issues that we live under, where we are, that it's not one way. So the on the listening process website, on the web pages, the listening process, you'll find summaries from around the world, and they're there. It's not measurable, you know, this one's got 5 out of 10, or this one's got 10 out of 10, or something like that. It's not measurable at all. And even in your own province, what's gone on in one diocese is different to what's gone on in another diocese. And if you were to measure things by, well, some people would want to measure them by how many dioceses the successful result of a listening process is that we're now, you know, in New Westminster or something like that. I don't think that at all. A successful, I mean, Terry Buckle, for example, listens to the experience of gay and lesbian people from a very conservative position. But gay and lesbian people feel very much listened to, or Duncan Gray in Mississippi, without changing his own beliefs about that. So it's absolutely impossible to measure. The dioceses themselves, the provinces themselves, have the responsibility. And they're to monitor what's going on, to share best practice, and to attempt to give some resources. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to give marks out of 10 here and marks out of 10 there.
Just a follow-up. Can I ask you, are you satisfied with the level of engagement that's been happening? I understand that there are different processes happening.
Never satisfied. I mean, we're proclaiming the good news of Jesus Christ, and to do that, we're always looking to do it better. So I would be hoping that we would be doing more. So, but it, you know, it is as it is, and the provinces are there, and what I can do to help is what I can do to help.
Colin Coward, Changing Attitude England. As a gay man, this question comes from a rather different perspective, I think.
Sure.
The process that's being proposed, which I think is wonderful, seems to me to be oriented towards helping heterosexual people have conversations more than lesbian and gay people, though they will be part of it, as your answer to the previous question says. They are already. One of the places where lesbian and gay voices are not heard is in the instruments of communion, the structures. So that although a group was invited at Lambeth 98 to come and meet with the subsection, that encounter didn't happen. Nobody participated in Lambeth 2008. There's nobody here who is involved in the meeting and giving voice directly to LGBT experience. And the same was true of the primates meeting, even though there are primates who are gay. Do you have any way of working towards enabling LGBT voices to be heard directly by the councils of the communion? That's a really tough question.
Well, it's also in the notion of where decisions are made and what the idea of the process of listening is about. So what you're asking for is, are the councils of the church, are the instruments of communion going to hear the voices of LGBT people? But my role has actually been monitoring the work in dioceses, provinces, and not in the councils. And so this is actually about also engaging provinces where gay and lesbian people are part of diocese, that they may be able to have an inclusion in the conversations, which are not just kind of focusing on them, sitting the gay person in the middle of the room, or the person who might describe themselves as having same-sex attraction or something like that, while everybody else sits around and investigates them, which I think is pretty appalling. It's about including people with It's about kind of going the other way and including how are we going to discover together those who are actually genuine leaders in mission in our churches are often those who are doing Mother's Union in Ghana or Nigeria. They're often the youth officer somewhere else. How are they going to come together and to hear the realities of the world that they're in? Somebody a while back, I was talking with a Kenyan. He said, "You know, I've got two family friends, and they've got children who have this thing, and I don't know how to advise the family pastorally. What is it I'm supposed to say?" And just being able to share that, and then to be able to exchange those kind of views, but actually to hear the experience of gay Christians. Both how they you know, how do they respond in Oliver O'Donovan's statement to bring the good news of Jesus Christ as evangelists of the church to the church? So in an essay by Oliver O'Donovan on the Fulcrum website, which was Good News for Gay Christians, he brought that, you know, he asked that question from an evangelical perspective. I think that's useful. So what you're saying is that, I mean, were there no gay voices at, you know, the reality is that the councils of the church are not representative in that form that you're saying. I mean, there's only one woman on the primates. There are no youth on the primates. The bishops, I mean, inevitably, how could there be? You know, you can't pick a 15-year-old primate to that. So they're not representative in that way. They never will be. So there can't be a representative in that form. They're representative of the province. You know, they're from the provinces. I don't think that there is any way, any mechanism that what you're asking for could happen. I'm not sure that it's necessarily the right thing to happen. So that's not particularly what I'm involved in.
David? Yes, I have a question. It seems to us in many ways that the bias of this current, of this listening process is towards the gay thing rather than those who are not gay. Now, you've talked let me finish my question.
Yeah.
You've talked about gays, and I don't hear anything about ex-gays, and what about those people, many of whom running into the tens of thousands, who are now saying, we don't like same-sex attractions, we want out, and they are actually making their way out of the gay lifestyle. Are you listening to their voices, those who are in the process of healing, and saying, we no longer believe we want to be homosexual, and that we want to be straight, that we want to move out of that, or at least be celibate? And because I was in a conference 2 weeks ago in London, which was put on by Anglican Mainstream, that was dealing precisely with that issue, and I saw hundreds of men who were saying, we want out. Now, are you listening to their voices?
Okay. It's interesting because Colin's just said, you're not talking about gay people, and now you're saying we're only talking about gay people.
Right.
It's what we're hearing. When I replied to Colin, I said a gay person or someone who would describe themselves with same-sex attraction is what I actually said. I think probably on record, it's certainly what I intended. That might be those exact people you were thinking of. On the Anglican Communion website, the Anglican Communion and Homosexuality, Mario Bergner thanked me for listening to him as nobody else has listened before. His contributions up on the Anglican Communion website. We have the testimonies of ex-gays. We have links into the Zacchaeus Fellowship. The Zacchaeus Fellowship have been part of the statements, that part of the work we've done. And I consult with people like Peter Old and others within the communion. So that voice has been part, will be part, and certainly not excluded. Terry Buckle, I just mentioned, is the chaplain to the Zacchaeus Fellowship, and therefore he is one of those people in Canada who's very closely aligned to those kind of groups. So I think yes, absolutely. Part of that.
Robert Lundy with the American Anglican Council. The Satcher Health Institute is funding the Continuing Endowment Project until the end of 2011. Can you tell me how much money that group has promised or has given or will give to the Continuing Endowment Project?
It will be enough to pay salaries, expenses, a lot of moving of people. So it's a substantial sum of money, and it is towards $1.5 million.
U.S.? And a follow-up question on that, if I'm okay. The Satcher Health Institute has a Center of Excellence for Sexual Health,
yes,
which
is that,
fully funded by the Ford Foundation. Right. Ford Foundation, it came out, has written a report, and in it they say that their aims are to reduce the ability of vocal fundamentalists to sustain what they call attacks on LGBT rights. Doesn't that undermine Continuing Endowment Project if the funding is coming from groups that are clearly of one particular viewpoint and committed to that viewpoint?
That is not the source of their funding for this project. I it has been very clear all along from their work with us that that is not the interest that they have with us, and we have that absolutely in writing and completely not part of the basis for this funding.
Can we have the writing?
I think you have the paper given out of the statement that they made there. But in private conversations, absolutely, we absolutely made that. You can have in writing that the Ford Foundation is nothing to do with this at all.
Can I come back to Indaba? Mm-hmm. Indabas are used in well-defined communities, yeah. Traditional communities, with clear boundaries, either biological or geographical. Mm. Anglicans do not exist in well-defined communities. Mm. Indabas are in communities with well-defined lines of authority, membership, and a moral framework, which are not questioned in the Indaba process, because the Indaba process is about, given those things, finding out answers to questions now posed to the community. So to use the Indaba process to debate issues of authority and morality in the Anglican Communion is to use a process it was never intended or designed so to do. So hasn't Indaba, in one sense, been uprooted and being... the word's probably a bit too strong, but inappropriately used in order to address these issues. And when I mean inappropriately, I mean, what would have happened to the church if the Indaba process, as currently set out, had been used in the Arian controversy?
But you look at all processes we do as a church, we claim ourselves to be a family. But there isn't the kind of biological use. The image of the church as family is not the family that we thought of. We talk about cutting the loyalties of that we have to our individual culture, to our loyalties to Christ, who's now Lord. So when Paul calls Christ as Lord, he's calling on all kinds of images of Caesar, which are using the societal norms and changing them to talk about the new situation that he sees himself. We always do this with the church. We take a society and we try and find societal models to try and work as a church. That is inevitable. We're no longer saying that we are defined by our Englishness or by our support for whichever football team or the fact that someone is an Mgogo or a Bantu or a Luo or anything like that. And we're saying we're in this new community. Now, what are the societal rules that run for that community? We've assumed them to be Western cultural values so many times. So why we need to look at other societal models as well, because actually it means that it ends up always being that kind of, you know, we're using Western societal models, which are just as equally open to that kind of abuse. One of the things I think about the Lambeth Conference, it seems to me like my first curry. You know, the first curry I had was a beef stew with some curry powder put in. Now, if I want a curry, if I want a really curry now, you know, you go and you start with the base ingredients. What are those base ingredients? So a very significant part of this will be actually to go work with African theologians on working out actually what is that. And let's go and talk to North American indigenous peoples. What other models can we use, just as Paul did? I mean, my special interest is Paul and Philippians. And some people argue that it's a societas relationship, a formal legal partnership. But it isn't quite between Paul and the Philippian community. It isn't quite. He changes it. He moves it. He takes it out of his cultural roots and puts it into something else. We do that with everything. We've got nothing else to work with as a church. So I understand that criticism. It is in danger of being manipulated as everything else is. We need to go to African theologians to ensure that that danger is reduced and start from building up.
Why don't we go around one more time, and we'll give each person one more shot. Mary Frances?
I'm going to pass.
Your pass, Tess?
Can you identify the five pilot areas for this conversation?
I mean, we've only secured this funding. We've had initial conversations, but I wouldn't want to. They're not fully committed to, and I wouldn't want to place bishops, dioceses in a. Well, we want to take places where there is confidence and the ability to engage across a diocese. So a bishop, it feels confident in his people talking to one another. So we will be looking, let's say, for example, an African diocese. We're going to need one where the people are going to be confident to stand for what they believe in. We're not going to try and use an African to manipulate the position, an African diocese that can be manipulated. We'll be looking for confident theological voices, people involved in mission. And we will want to look at least some. We may be using pilot conversations with two or three dioceses. We'll be looking at places, for example, David, a place which I actually said yesterday, that lives with gay and lesbian people being accepted in its society, but the diocese may not have said that's the right way. Blessing same-sex unions is not the right response to that. So finding a diocese that has taken a conservative line in that kind of place. Find a diocese which is perhaps on the edge or moving towards the blessing of same-sex unions, where gay people are openly present in partnerships in churches, to engage in that face-to-face conversation will be part of that mix to ensure that we have really hard face-to-face conversations. And at times people will be going, I think you're wrong, directly, across, with facilitation, but actually talking directly to one another and facing that, what are the implications of the gospel in our world. And so those will be the kind of characteristics. But we will be looking for a variety and trying to see how, when we have Christians have conversations together, where we get to. And it carries risk. I mean, it does carry risk on both sides, on every side.
David? Yeah, you make a lot of culture when you talk, Phil, just a lot. Yet, that strikes me as kind of odd, because when I sit down with Archbishops Arombi, Akinola, Nzimbi, and Collini, who represent probably 75% of the Anglican Communion, we're on exactly the same page. I'm a dead white male from America, and yet our view of sexuality requires no more theological discussion. From their perspective, the Bible says that clearly this behavior is wrong, that sex stays within marriage, and we're not talking polygamy now. Why do you make such an issue of this when it's very clear that many of us have no problem when we sit down together saying this is the way it is, and he comes from one completely different culture, different color and everything than myself, and yet we see no contradiction whatever?
I think there are assumptions, for example, about human rights, which are made as determining factors in the Western Church. And the assumptions of human rights, when looked at in terms of community rights and community understandings within Africa, mean that while that may be true for you, David, it's not true for the whole church. And therefore, we need to question whether, how is it we approach issues? Is it, okay, well, human rights says that, people need to be able to choose, or what is it about community rights? So that's talked about within the Anglican Communion on homosexuality, but also because the Virginia Report has talked about the understanding, the interpretation of the good news of Jesus Christ in the cultures. We are constantly interpreting, speaking. Therefore, Zach Naringe talks of Acts 17, Paul going into to Athens to interpret the gospel in a culture which not only changes the way he speaks of the gospel, but changes how he understands the gospel. My own experience, I've lived for 6 years, I lived for a year with Henry Arombi in Uganda, and I discovered the gospel from living there. My cultural eyes that I'd seen the gospel through were shaken. And I suddenly discover this that things that I had assumed to be correct were wrong. But also, I was with Arombi when he organised a youth conference, and I was sitting in a Bible study. And you know, in Uganda, to be saved, to be born again, is a mark of true Christianity. To be Christian is a statement that you are not saved, because that's a statement of just following the line of Christendom and of the church. And they were interpreting Thessalonians, where Paul says Christians, they said these are people who are going to hell. And I had to say, hang on a minute, that's not what Paul understands by Christian. That might be what you understand in your culture, but it's not what Paul. We are always enlightened by seeing the gospel through another culture. It helps us. It breaks our preset ways of seeing things.
Robert?
Yesterday, Bishop Cameron said that there is a deep concern that the Anglican Communion can't make decisions that stick. How does the listening process help that?
Because when you make decisions, and you make them at a kind of top level, and the people have been on a journey to get to those points that you make, to not include ordinary members of the church in that same journey, it gives you a division, makes it difficult to happen. So it's how we include people in that journey to come to the point where we are together making decisions. I think then there's a possibility. I'm not saying this will work. What I'm saying is worth trying, and it's that it's a significant. We're not saying this is going to work. We're saying this is a way that explores how we can be the church more fully in the way that the New Testament gives some indication of.
So the listening process may not work.
Everything, nothing. What process can you guarantee will work? I mean, it's something to encourage people to be involved in that process. I'm not going to stand here and say this is the answer to all our problems, because I think that's too big a claim. It may be, and we look to the New Testament to find models which might assist us. If Paul goes to Corinth, he doesn't support one side over another within their divisions, but calls them to recognize as Christ of Lord of that whole church and engages them. What are you know, these are some of the basic truths, but how are you going to come back together as a one church? It isn't that he sends the issues off to a commission, but asks them to be part of the journey to find out what the truth is. I suppose if the Arian controversy, if we'd entered into a listening process, there was a fair amount of violence and dispute and people being thrown out here and everywhere. Maybe it would have worked better. I don't know. We don't know, but maybe it would have done. We may have come to the same truths, but in a way that was brought everybody on board to those same truths. That's what I would hope.
Chris, the last one to you.
You are saying that the ACC, as we are experiencing it this week, is sort of retrialing the Indaba process. You know, you mentioned about
it
was tried at Lambeth, and that was like a first curry, and now you're trying to. My impression of the plenary debates that we've seen is that they're not examples, clearly not, of Western, as you've said, adversarial processes. They look to me more like meetings of the Supreme Soviet, because you get a motion before the House, one or two brave souls get up and make a comment that is a slight tangent to the motion. That comment goes nowhere, and then the voting is, you know, those content say aye, not content nay, carry on. And one or two people have said to me that there just isn't space appropriately for proper debate on the floor on what's brought. So how are we to understand, is this a further trialing of Indaba that really hasn't succeeded? Or do you see the processes we're seeing worked out on the floor of the ACC at the moment as an improvement on Lambeth, and this is what we might expect in diocesan synods and elsewhere?
I mean, I think it's for people to take on their own take on that. I mean, I can't stand in judgment on the ACC. I've been busy preparing my presentation, haven't been to as many plenaries as you have been. And people have said to me, what do we really like are those discernment groups, because actually I'm able to speak there without fully forming my ideas. I'm able to speak in a language which is not my own. I'm able to say things and be heard. Now, how we translate that very positive into the resolutions is a problem, and it may be one that we continue to need to work at. But those kind of preformed resolutions are actually preformed, hopefully, in the light of the discernment group. So we hope that there is some play between that area and not just relying on the plenary. So although, you know, we are not, I don't think anybody's going to suggest that there is perfection. There is an attempt to hear the voice of all those who are present and to break from adversarial to the point where we come to some form of consensus. It's never going to be perfect, Chris, and we will always need to then move that on. If diocesan synods, general synods want to use to Indaba, they can learn from the mistakes, they can learn and grow, and possibly we may find a way forward, which means that we find greater unity.
Thank you.